This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on October 7th. From history.com, the civil rights movement was a struggle for social justice that took place mainly during the 1950s and 1960s for Black Americans to gain equal rights under the law in the United States. The Civil War had officially abolished slavery, but it didn't end discrimination against Black people. They continued to endure the devastating effects of racism, especially in the South. By the mid-20th century, Black Americans had had more than enough of prejudice and violence against them. They, along with many white Americans, mobilized and began an unprecedented fight for equality that spanned two decades. From a 1962 essay by James Baldwin in The New Yorker, titled "Letter from a Region in My Mind," "We, the Black and the White, deeply need each other here if we are really to become a nation. If we are really, that is, to achieve our identity, our maturity as men and women. To create one nation has proved to be a hideously difficult task. What one would not like to see again is the consolidation of peoples on the basis of their color. But as long as we in the West place on color the value that we do, we make it impossible for the great unwashed to consolidate themselves according to any other principle. Color is not a human or a personal reality. It is a political reality. But this is a distinction so extremely hard to make that the West has not been able to make it yet. And at the center of this dreadful storm, this vast confusion, stand the Black people of this nation, who must now share the fate of a nation that has never accepted them, to which they were brought in chains. Well, if this is so, one has no choice but to do all in one's power to change that fate, and at no matter what risk, eviction, imprisonment, torture, death. For the sake of one's children, in order to minimize the bill that they must pay, one must be careful not to take refuge in any delusion. And the value placed on the color of the skin is always and everywhere and forever a delusion. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is Carol Johnson, the first ever civil rights officer for the city of Austin. The position was created to advance the city's non-discrimination efforts and promote outreach, education, and awareness events for both businesses and community stakeholders. We're also joined by Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of this program. Thanks for joining us, Carol.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We'd like to hear just a little about your own background. Where were you before and what brought you to Austin?
Sure. So I actually passed immediately from Seattle, but I really started my civil rights career in Arkansas. So I had the privilege and honor of starting the first civil rights enforcement agency for the state of Arkansas. And there I worked for three Arkansas governors, beginning with Mike Huckabee when he was governor of Arkansas. So I had the opportunity of working in a bipartisan capacity with three governors, two of whom were Republican governors, to create an enforcement mechanism there where none existed. And so from there, I moved to the Pacific Northwest and served as the director of civil rights for the state of Oregon, and also worked as the regional director for programs and compliance for Region 10 for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And that region covered the states of Washington, Oregon, Alaska, and Idaho. I am a practicing attorney and went into civil rights because I really wanted to be in a place where I could help other people. I believe strongly in social justice and equity, and believe that this was the calling for me.
First, I'm impressed. Austin's very lucky to have you. The Pacific Northwest, you mentioned Oregon. You know, it's just in recent years that I've learned some of the history of Oregon. I imagine that was a bit of a challenge for you.
It absolutely was. I think I said I had to travel halfway across the country, I guess, to really understand the full scope and breadth of where we are in the country in terms of civil rights. You know, I think people kind of look at different geographical areas and they think, oh, one place is worse than another, or one place is better than another. And I've seen just firsthand that we all struggle with these issues, no matter where we're located geographically. Oregon has an interesting civil rights past and legacy, and really came into the Union as a very segregated place. So, and that's probably a long story for another time, but it was right. Interesting and rewarding also to be able to have the opportunity to kind of work with the state there to advance civil rights there.
And even Austin has a very interesting history of segregation, but we'll get into that in a little bit here. Maybe you could start off talking a little about the office that you're heading up. You are the first director of this. Is that right?
That is correct. The first civil rights officer actually in Texas. And I'm really proud to be here in a city that is as progressive and forward-thinking as Austin is. I really applaud city leadership, mayor and council, the city manager, for really thinking and being deliberate about how we're going to approach civil rights enforcement, education outreach within the city, and how we're going to make this the best place in the world, if it could get any better, you know, to live. So the office was created, the authority for it, back in August of 2020. And, you know, the mandate came down to look to see, you know, how we're going to actually establish this office. I actually came on in February of this year. And since that time, we have been building, establishing the infrastructure for the office. So the Office of Civil Rights is really created to provide a centralized place to enforce civil rights. You know, the city had civil rights enforcement already in certain areas. You know, we had some folks in the HR department that were, you know, investigating housing and employment as well. But the city wanted to be strategic and comprehensive in creating an office that would really, really ensure that we were looking at civil rights in all areas and enforcing, you know, the breadth and scope of the civil rights laws and mandate that we have authority to enforce.
Did they provide you with any staff positions for this?
Yeah, we actually do have staff. So I receive some staff. Once we are fully staffed, we will have approximately 16 folks within the office, and that will help us advance our mission, which is, you know, to really advance civil rights and labor standards through thoughtful community and business engagement, through strategic enforcement and strategic community engagement and innovative policy development, all with that commitment to race and social justice. So we have filled a couple of the new positions already. We got 3 more positions in this last budget cycle. So we are going to be looking to fill those positions as well in the next few weeks.
You mentioned that the office was actually created last August 2020. I would infer from that it was no coincidence that it happened right on the heels of the BLM protests. Am I reading too much into that?
No, this office was really created out of the whole reimagining public safety initiative. And as we know, came on the heels of, the murder of George Floyd. Some of the funding for our office was redirected from the Austin Police Department to create this entity that would work in tandem with other city offices to really ensure that we're responsive to the needs of our community. We want to make sure that we understand all of the issues that we're facing, that we're responsive to that, and that we, efficiently and effectively advance the city's mission to eliminate barriers, institutional barriers to racial and social justice. So it certainly was not coincidental, and again, very deliberate on the part of city leadership to show our intention to effectively enforce civil rights within Austin.
Carol, you were talking about the creation of the Office of Civil Rights. Could you tell us about the relationship to the City of Austin Equity Office?
Sure, absolutely. We work as the Office of Civil Rights in collaboration with the Equity Office and other offices within the city. The mission and the work that the Civil Rights Office is doing is very different from that of the Equity Office in that we enforce laws. So, we have a team of investigators and folks who actually, investigate cases from the initial intake phase to the investigation phase to the prosecution or litigation phase, if it comes to that. So our work is really mostly outward facing in that we take complaints also from the public about things that are happening within the city limits. But then we have the additional, again, component of being an actual enforcement entity. So we actually, take complaints that people make regarding civil rights violations that they may have experienced, and we enforce those. The Equity Office, though, works to make sure that there's diversity and inclusion within the city and addresses, issues such as that throughout the city. But our difference is in that we are an enforcement agency.
Got it. Well, speaking of enforcement, we've also had Farrah Muscadin on the show a couple of times. Do you have any relationship with OPO?
So, yes, certainly. And I would just say that, we are working in collaboration, with all of these offices, the Equity Office, right, the OPO, APD, in collaboration, really as a holistic approach to reducing inequities within the system and right, within the city. And so, in doing that, it is important that, we partner with other city entities and with, other community organizations throughout the city. Again, working towards systemic equality, addressing just this whole legacy of racism and systemic discrimination that, quite frankly, as governmental entities have helped to perpetuate throughout, the years. Working with the Office of Police Oversight and Accountability, working with APD to make sure we address, those issues in civil rights that people are dealing with at this time. So right, one of the initiatives I can, really talk to you about is we recently did a workshop series with the police department called Civil Rights ATX. And the first series in that workshop is entitled Combating Hate Violence in the AAPI community. So the Asian American Pacific Islander community. And we worked with the department to create a workshop series that really addressed what is a civil rights violation first. Let's talk about that. What type of offense rises to the level of a hate crime? When is it appropriate to report your whatever it is that you've experienced it, whether it's discrimination or a bias or hate crime or violence? Where do you report that? What is the difference in a civil rights enforcement effort from the criminal side? And how does that differ from the civil side, which is what we do at the Office of Civil Rights, as opposed to, you know, criminal investigation and enforcement from APD? And again, you know, with the increase, because, you know, there's always been hate violence against the AAPI community, but certainly there has been an increase in bias and discrimination and racism with the onset of COVID. Just the whole idea that somehow related to the Asian American community. Right. And so we really wanted to create an avenue or a way or in a workshop that would empower the community. How can you be a good neighbor? You know, when you see these things happening to others, what should your response be? What should you do? How do you intervene in a safe way? But how do you intervene? What are some of those best practices? You know, our office is looking at and currently in the process of developing a community bystander toolkit. Right. Because right. I think it's really going to take all of us to address and really combat. And when you're talking about, you know, discrimination and hate and bias, whether it be implicit or explicit, you're talking about really trying to change the way people think. And then changing the way they react to that, you know, and we need to create a culture and an environment that says it's not okay for you to think this way. Right. So if, you know, somebody is saying something to you in a conversation and you have an opportunity to intervene, that's what you should do. Because I think it's only through that in our experiences and our interactions with others that we're going to grow and create the society that we all want to have. I really feel like, you know, it starts there and empowering people to be okay with saying, no, that's not okay.
That's encouraging to hear. We actually did a show on the AAPI community and the Stop Asian Hate. I think they had a rally back in April, if I recall, and we talked to a couple of the organizers right before that. Speaking of other organizations, your own goals align with those of several organizations in the city. I can think of the Austin Justice Coalition, for example. We've had Chaz Moore on the show here a number of times, Grassroots Leadership, and others. What's your relationship to the nonprofit organizations like that?
I will tell you that, you know, nonprofit grassroots organizations have been really the backbone, as you know, to the civil rights movement generally. Right. It's important. Everyone plays a very unique role. Government plays a role. Community plays a role. Organizations play a role. And it is so important and critical that we all work collaboratively with each other, because there are things that grassroots organizations can do that government may not be able to do, and vice versa. And I think really understanding the dynamics of those types of relationships that are necessary are a critical component. So the first thing that I did, or one of the first things that I did when I came and took on the role and the position, was reached out to the grassroots organizations. I wanted to talk to as many folks as possible. And we will be, in addition to that, doing a listening tour. So sometime at the beginning of the year, expect to see us in different venues. And if we still can't meet in person, then we'll be doing some virtual listening sessions. But again, because we understand how critical it is to have those relationships. You know, I have talked with disability rights groups here, the NAACP here, ACLU, the Urban League. I was able to, you know, connect with our chapter here. But again, it's important, you know, we don't need to reinvent the wheel because there's a wealth of information and knowledge and expertise already out there. I met with each of the chambers of commerce, the affinity chambers. So, you know, the Asian American, the African American, the Latino, the LGBTQ, and was able to establish, you know, relationships there. But again, we have to work together. And I think we all understand that, you know, regardless of whatever differences is, we all are working towards the same goal. And so we're going to have to work collaboratively in order to, again, you know, achieve that ultimate goal, which is reducing and eliminating barriers to everything, you know, to housing, to education, to employment, you know, to public accommodations, to health, all of those disparities which permeate through our society right now.
Backing up just a little, you were talking about the formation of your office and you mentioned the Reimagining Public Safety Task Force. Their report came out in April. I'm guessing that you were kind of on the tail end of that, but were you involved at all with the task force?
No, I really wasn't. I came in February, really mid-February. And it's so funny because I came in the middle of COVID, obviously, but also in the middle of the snowstorm. So I actually got here and the day before it happened. And the week that I started was the week that the city the city was shut down. And so I was kind of in the middle of all the chaos, but certainly understand our role and, you know, the role of the Office of Civil Rights in reimagining public safety, you know, and what that means. It's a very serious commitment that the city has and that we have to ensuring that we meet the needs of our community.
You know, I'd like to reassure you that that's not what winners are like, but I'm afraid that's just, that may just be wishful thinking.
Well, the weather is certainly making up for it now. So I'm definitely enjoying where we are here in Austin.
Switching gears a little bit here, we also talked about the BLM protests. One of the things that we've known about for some time, but I think Farrah Muskaden really underscored just a couple of weeks ago, is first the large number of complaints against APD. And, you know, you contrast that with what seems to be the very few number of cases that were actually investigated. And I know that's her area, but do you have any reaction to that or any comment on that?
You know, I can't add to the fact that we have to do better. We've got to. That's not an option for us. And I really applaud Director Muskaden and the amazing work that she is doing there to bring so many issues to light and to really address this. But we've got to do better. I think as a city, as a state, as a country, we need to take ownership of where we are. And then we need to begin to heal. And the only way to do that is to be accountable. And we can't be accountable if we're not doing the things that we need to be doing. So I will just say that, you know, obviously there's still a lot of work to be done. We need to be actively engaged. We need to be holding, you know, city offices, ours included, accountable. And we need to understand, you know, that until we continue to do that and push, nothing is going to change. You know, we're going to be in the same boat that we've always been. I appreciate the difficulty of the task ahead. I understand it's a lot, you know, and there's a lot of things that we need to address. One of the things that I've asked the police department, and I'm really excited about this, we will be receiving, you know, copies of the reports when somebody reports what they believe to be a hate crime. And now the process with the police department is that it goes to a committee. And the committee actually kind of reviews the circumstances of the event and they determine within their committee whether or not they believe that the incident actually rose to the level of a civil rights hate crime. And so they have been really very open in providing us with copies of those reports as they come out. That's something that I intend to monitor. We want to create a pipeline between the police department and the Office of Civil Rights. Even in those events that they don't believe it rises to the level of a hate crime, it could still be, you know, an issue or an area that the Office of Civil Rights can investigate from the civil side. And so this is an important step to making sure that nobody falls through the cracks, that right. no case falls through the cracks. You know, I think that moving forward, we're going to establish, you know, some mechanisms and some protocols and some things that we can do to make sure that we're not leaving people out, that we're serving our vulnerable communities, that we're serving our disenfranchised communities, and that we're doing what we're intended to do.
Sure.
Hey, I wonder, given that you've lived in other jurisdictions and other states and worked in those areas as well, what is your sense of how Austin is handling the situation, given we now have the Equity Office, we have the Office of Police Oversight, we now have the Civil Rights Office? How does Austin compare dealing with the problem of, you know, police violence and police misconduct to other places you've lived in and worked in?
I think that Austin, as is other, you know, jurisdictions, Austin is struggling with the issue of how to handle police interactions with the public. I think that, again, I mean, we have a lot of work to do. I do believe that Austin is one of the more progressive cities in the ways that it has been attempting to handle this issue. You know, again, just reimagining public safety, being the first city to actually create a civil rights officer. And then creating the Office of Civil Rights tells me that they're very intentional and are being very deliberate in how they want to focus on public safety and public safety issues. There is a lot of mistrust, and I'm going to say it's been earned, not just in our jurisdiction, but in other jurisdictions across the country. There's a lot of mistrust between the community and the police. I mean, when you see that people of color are disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice system, I didn't mention earlier, but back in the day, I was a former deputy prosecutor in Arkansas. I was actually the first African-American deputy prosecutor in my county. And you see firsthand how the disparities exist in the criminal justice system. And so we have to be systemic in how we address all of these issues. So it's not just, you know, interactions with police, it's interactions with the court system, it's interactions with the judges, it's interactions with the prison system, it's all of that.
Our guest this evening is Carol Johnson, Director of the Office of Civil Rights for the City of Austin. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on October 7th. Our guest this evening is Carol Johnson, Director of the Office of Civil Rights for the City of Austin. Let's pick up where we left off.
We need to be accountable. I can't say that enough. You know, if things are happening or continue to happen in the community, we need to be vocal. We need to be visible. We need to be consistent and we need to be persistent. So, you know, I think we're all going to play a very critical role in ensuring that we as a city, we as a city government, we as a city government body, do what it is we're being paid to do.
So let's assume for the moment that this is nirvana. We know that it's not, but there's a lot to be hopeful about in Austin. I want to contrast that with the larger state that we live in. Some say that we're a blue island in a red sea. And I know that your purview pretty much ends at the city limits. The problem is that we've got this Texas legislature that sometimes seems to have Austin in the crosshairs. The third special session is dealing with redistricting. And so far, we've seen that that isn't working out very well for people of color. We could go into voting rights. We can talk about abortions. We can talk about the assault on transgender persons, another issue that's front and center, even as we speak here. I don't know where to go with all this, but how does that color your view of what your job is about?
Well, I think that just reiterates that we have a big task ahead of us and that there's a lot of things to do and people need to be engaged and people need to understand what's at stake. What's at stake with redistricting? How does that affect you? And sometimes that's really difficult, you know, especially when you're talking about disenfranchised communities. They're just worried about putting food on the table, deciding whether they're going to pay for medicine, or are they going to be able to go to the grocery store, or, you know, where they're going to live and how they're going to pay for rent. You know, you've got the moratorium on evictions that's being lifted. There are so many issues. And so I think it's critical that we help folks understand what's at stake for each of these issues. And that, again, is where our collaboration as a city with grassroots organizations actually come into play. Because obviously as a city, you know, as an Office of Civil Rights, we're not going to be able to be everywhere at all places. One of the things that I am creating within the Office of Civil Rights are a couple advisory groups. So we'll have a civil rights advisory group, and we'll also have a labor standards advisory group. And we're going to put that together with just, you know, members of our community who care about Austin, who care about improving the quality of life for the people who live here, who care about social justice issues, who care about gender justice issues, you know, who care about disability rights issues. And actually having boots on the ground, again, is an important part of that. But making sure people understand what's at stake, empowering them to speak up, being able to speak up for those people who don't feel like they have a voice or have so many other issues in front of them that they just can't. We have to continue to move and be a force and be a voice for all the people here in Austin.
Well, I was curious about the plans for any kind of public service type of campaign that the Civil Rights Office might take on. You're talking earlier a little bit about educating the public. I'm just curious if there's any thoughts about some sort of formalized campaign. And also, when I moved to Austin 3 years ago, there was already in progress campaign the mayor started about the workshops that he was imploring residents in the city to take through Courageous Conversations. I did that. I thought that was really helpful, but it, you know, it's something that was really afforded to people that could afford to do that. So it's not, you know, something that was community-wide availability. But I'm curious to know if that's something that's on the radar of the Office of Civil Rights, is just some sort of like get out information to the public in a more broad way.
Sure, absolutely. One of the things that we're working on right now is a public information campaign called ATX Aware. And we've been working with a vendor to get that out. So hopefully within the next probably couple of months or so, you'll begin to see some ads and a campaign around ATX Aware, You Have Rights. We're really excited about that. And we're hoping to launch that at the same time that we launch our conversations that we're going to have. So the community discussions that we'll be having, the focus tour around the community, we're hoping to kind of launch that collectively. You know, I'll mention again the other campaigns that we've been doing with combating hate violence in the AAPI community, and also the Fair Chance Hiring we've been doing. We had a four-part series on Fair Chance Hiring, on the ordinance, and talking to employers and talking to the community about, you know, what fair chance hiring is, what it means to the reentry community, what it means to businesses, and how this ordinance really helps to remove barriers for folks who have criminal background histories.
Since the office is so new, you're probably focused more on getting started and goals and whatnot. At some point, you're going to be facing your own accountability. Do you report to the city manager, to city council? Who do you report to, and what are they going to evaluate the office on?
And our mission is really focused around advancing civil rights and labor standards. When the office was created, and even through the recruitment process, we really talked a lot about outreach and education and looking at ways that we can improve policies just to ensure, even within city government, that we're looking at all areas. One of the areas that we're actually enforcing that we didn't necessarily enforce previously was Title VI. And Title VI involves any public entity that receives, you know, public money, federal, state, public money. And so we're looking at ways that we can ensure that we're meeting all of the Title VI requirements. And then Title VII, as you know, dealing with employment and the EEOC, Title VII, and then Title VIII dealing with HUD and the housing. Right now, we have engagements with the EEOC and with HUD to enforce fair housing, fair lending legislation, and to enforce employment legislation. We are working closely with them to ensure that we are meeting all of the requirements within those contracts with our federal partners. You know, I think for us, it's going to look like how have we actively engaged the public. It's really, really important from the city's standpoint and to me as well that people understand that we are here. And I think that's an important component. You know, if you have a civil rights office that nobody knows exists, how effective can you really be? So it's really important for folks to know that we're here, to know that they can come to us with issues that they have and feel certain that those issues will be addressed within this overall scheme of the organizational chart. I directly report to the deputy city manager and to the city manager. The city has placed a great amount of importance on the Office of Civil Rights and the work that it's doing. And I think that that will bear out. There's a lot of work to be done, and it's not going to be done overnight. And, you know, some of the challenges that we face just by the virtue of being a civil rights agency is compounded by COVID. Struggling with how can we be more accessible to the community and be safe at the same time, right? And so we deal with those as other state and federal governmental agencies are as well. And we've dealt with some of those challenges. For example, our federal partners are still working remotely. In terms of our housing contracts require us to do on-site investigations in our housing cases. So we've continued to do that. But again, it's really challenging with COVID and trying to ensure that we're meeting the public need, but we're also able to, you know, protect our investigators and other staff members that are going out and doing what they do best.
At the beginning of the show, I read a quote from the website history.com. It talked about the civil rights movement spanning two decades in the past century. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I mean, like I heard a lot when the protests started and after, you know, George Floyd, that we were living in unprecedented times. We're not living in unprecedented times. These things have been happening for years and years and decades and decades, you know, violence and protests and police brutality against African-Americans and other people of color. That's been happening forever. So we're not living in unprecedented times. You know, I just think about from the very beginning, the Elaine massacre, which happened in Arkansas, Black Wall Street. That was what, early 1900s, 1918, 1919, around that time. So we're not living in unprecedented times. I think we're beginning to be more aware through the use of technology and things being videoed and information being mobile and more easily accessible and more quickly communicated. That's what we're seeing now. Civil rights, that's been going on for a long time. And I think that we're going to continue to see these issues until we are deliberate and intentional and creative and progressive and innovative about how we're going to address them.
Yeah, I think we're very much on the same wavelength there. It almost sounded like they were saying it began and ended back in the 50s and 60s. You know, it seems like the struggle just continues. We're very appreciative of your efforts here. It's great to have you here in the city of Austin. For our listeners, if they wanted more information about your office, where could they find it?
We have a website, and they can go to www.austintexas.gov/department/office-civil-rights. And on that website, they're also able to get information about civil rights. They can file a complaint if they would like to. There's information about upcoming workshops that we're having, a little bit of information about, you know, all of the areas that we enforce. And if you don't mind, I could mention those really quick in terms of Sure. our civil rights enforcement in the areas of housing and employment and public accommodations. And public accommodations are going to be any of those places that people gather, like hotels or restaurants, shopping malls, things of that nature, Title VI. And then for our labor standards enforcement, we enforce the HIV ordinance to protect folks that are suffering from HIV, Fair Chance Hiring Ordinance for the reentry community, a source of income for veterans. We have the Anti-Discrimination by City Contractors Ordinance. And then we also have the Equal Pay Act of 1963 that we process also in our office. But they can go onto that website, and if they want to file a complaint, they can do that online. Our telephone number is 512-974-3251. They can call our office. And we do have hybrid office hours. So I will also give our physical address, which is 1050 East 11th Street, Suite 200. And so they can also stop by the office as well.
Well, a lot of good information there. Carol, we really appreciate your taking time out to join us here today, and want to thank you and wish you the very best establishing the office and moving forward with this work that's still very much needed.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you again for having me. And thank you all for what you're doing in bringing awareness to the community on issues that are important. It's not something that is going to change overnight, but with partners like you, we can expect to see that change. Thank you.
It's Friday afternoon, October 8th, and we're speaking once again with Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How are you doing today, Austin?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Always a pleasure to have you here. Well, this beautiful Friday afternoon, I thought maybe we could pick up some loose ends on a lot of different stories. We were a little bit rushed last week, but the story last week was that the Firefighters Association came out against Prop A. Anything else happening on that or on Prop A in general?
Well, I have seen some of the ads that the Firefighters Association has produced on Facebook. They're just kind of short videos, and, you know, they're pretty straightforward. They really try and emphasize that the Firefighters Association opposition to Prop A should not be seen as like disrespect toward the police department or police officers. They agree that the department should hire more police officers. Their argument is they already have the funding they need to hire enough police officers. So it's not really a question of needing a bigger budget to do that. It's just different recruiting, maybe more police academies kind of thing. But to fund more officer positions, they're saying, would be a threat to other public safety sectors. Fire department is the second largest general fund service. That's the stuff funded by your taxes behind the police department. And so if the police department has to grow in size, then it's likely that other city services will have to forego new construction projects, new personnel hires, things of this nature. And with the fire department being the next biggest budget, that's a place where the city might have to look to find funding to fulfill the mandate proposed by Proposition A. So that's kind of the focus of the firefighters. Again, that this is a bad law, as Bob Nix, president of the Austin Firefighters Association, put it when he was announcing the association's opposition to Prop A, not really an attack on police officers.
And we'll remind our listeners that estimates
from the city accounting office, I believe, are that Prop A would wind up costing somewhere in the neighborhood of about $100 million a year.
Right. Yeah. And you know, there's reason to believe those estimates are on the low end, right? And there's some assumptions in that estimate that the budget office produced, primarily no wage increases for officers above cost of living, kind of inflation increases, which it's hard to imagine the Austin Police Association agreeing to that. They never have in the past. So for them to agree that their officers should not get raises above the inflation rate just because they need to hire more officers, it seems unlikely that that would happen. But yeah, somewhere in the vicinity of about $100 million a year for at least the next 5 years. But we also have to factor in HB 1900, the state law that we've talked about previously on your show, that prohibits cities from reducing their police department budget unless they get permission to do so from the governor. And that would mean if we increase the police budget by $100 million 1 year, we're likely never going to be able to decrease it. So that's a factor to consider as well.
Right. And the way around this, of course, is we don't have to raise the extra money. We'll just take it from somewhere else in the city. I noted a lot of the yard signs that I've seen, the opposition to Prop A basically are framing this in terms of libraries and other services.
Right, right, exactly. And the reason for that is because there's only two ways that the city could pay for Proposition A, the $100 million or so needed to fulfill it legally. One is by raising property taxes, but the state limits how much revenue can be generated from property taxes without holding elections. So we would have to get voter approval to raise the tax rate. The city was already planning to do that without even Prop A. So that means we would be facing an even higher property tax burden, which of course has been one of the factors that has displaced so many longtime residents in Austin. The other option is to cut services, right? To halt projects that would be new parks or cut services and programs at the library, things of this nature. Obviously, none of this stuff is on the table. It's kind of hypothetical, but that is why the opposition, the campaign against Prop A, has these signs that say protect parks and libraries, because they understand this is likely where funding to fulfill this mandate would come from in Prop A.
Right. Well, you mentioned APA a minute ago. How are things between the union and the new chief?
Well, it's been pretty rocky. The association has not been very kind to Chuck Owen since he was confirmed as chief recently. They released a poll that they conducted of members showing that he was by far the least liked candidate of the three chief finalists. They took him to task recently, basically firing a cadet in the police academy who had tested positive for COVID-19. I'm not totally sure the circumstances surrounding that, but they certainly sent out a press release, criticized him for it, and are really, you know, escalating tensions with the chief. Again, they really feel that they wanted an outside perspective to come in and lead the department to bring fresh ideas, new solutions to some of the problems that they have seen plaguing the department, which for them is primarily staffing. They are losing officers to retirements and resignations at record rates, and they really want to see the chief produce innovative solutions aimed at stopping that bleeding. Chuck Owen, in response, has said, not directly to the association, but in other media and to council, there's nothing to say that someone from APD can't bring fresh ideas, and that he's confident he can do that. But yeah, it's been a ratcheting up of tensions on APA's part. You know, Chuck Owen can't really respond to this, so he hasn't publicly. But APA is certainly pressing a campaign against him to try and bend him to their will.
Didn't I read this past week? You mentioned that one cadet was leaving the class because he had tested positive for COVID. Weren't there several that left the academy this past week?
Yeah, I think a total of 8 have left, and the circumstances for which they left, I'm not totally clear on. Although, you know, I'll add, it's not unusual for academies to see attrition like this, right? Cadet classes in the past have had officers drop out. Maybe they just realize they don't want to do this job. They're not physically or mentally fit enough to do it well. There's a number of reasons why. Maybe they just see the culture and they don't want to participate in that. And there's a number of reasons cadets would leave. I think the association's point is that they're so short-staffed, they can't afford to lose any cadets. And the chief should be doing more to retain as many as he can.
Right. Well, you mentioned COVID. A week ago, you had a really interesting article about vaccination and mask usage among first responders. Could you give us just a summary of that chart that you had there about the vaccination rates?
Right, yeah. I wanted to get a sense of how many public employees in different sectors are vaccinated. And first, before I talk the numbers, just a caveat that this data is pretty unreliable, unfortunately. Most of it is based on voluntary responses to surveys distributed by employers, incentives put on by employers to get people vaccinated, and they have to submit proof of vaccination. And of course, when an employer, a public employer, surveys their employees, the employees are not required. They can't be legally required to respond. So the data that we have is based on voluntary responses to surveys or incentives to prove that someone was vaccinated. That being said, what I found is based on that kind of data, somewhat unsurprisingly, EMS, our paramedics, have the highest vaccination rate among the employers I looked at. They estimate that about 91% of their employees are vaccinated. Fire has the second highest rate at 79%. Also, not terribly surprising since EMS and fire handle the most medical calls. They interact with doctors and nurses most frequently. So I think they just kind of have a greater exposure to COVID because they're dealing with sick people, but also just greater proximity to the healthcare systems, which may make them more likely to be vaccinated. And then at the end of the list, we have APD, which estimates that they have about a 50% vaccination rate. And I should note that APD's data is probably the least reliable, unfortunately. Their number, 50% number, is based on a survey that was administered last year, in April of last year, before a vaccine was even available. So they were just asking employees, if a vaccine or when a vaccine is available, will you get one? And so that's what the 50% number is based on. But APD officials told me they don't really see much value in conducting a new survey because of the reasons I mentioned. They can't force people to respond, so they're afraid that it won't give a very reliable picture of how many employees are vaccinated.
It sounded like you had to actually rely on some conversations with the chaplain for the police department.
Rick Randall is his name. He's the chaplain, and he also is the manager, the director of the health and wellness division at APD. So he kind of oversees the physical and mental and spiritual, as chaplain, health of employees at APD. Yeah, a lot of the context I got about this came from Rick Randall.
To me, the really amazing chart in that article had to do with on-the-job deaths, on-duty deaths of police. I think it was nationwide, right?
Yeah. This was looking at nationwide data.
Right. And, you know, you had the different categories there. But when you totaled up the deaths on the job, and then you compared that with the number of cops who have died from COVID, if I've got this right, in both years, 2020 and 2021, the COVID deaths actually exceeded all of the on-duty deaths. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. In 2020 and 2021, more officers died of COVID than all other causes combined. On-duty deaths, that is, making COVID-19 the largest threat to the safety of police officers. In 2020, 45 officers died of gunfire, which was the second most frequent cause of death for police officers. But 242 officers died of COVID-19 in that same year. So the level of threat that this virus has posed to officers who are on the front line interacting with members of the public probably more frequently than any other public sector employee, it's a grave threat. It's been a grave threat, which makes the mystery of why more officers are not vaccinated really puzzling question.
You know, that's exactly the issue, at least the issue in my mind. When when you think about people who are literally on the front lines and interacting with the public, and oftentimes at very close range, you know, things do get physical. It just amazes me that they're not all rushing out and getting vaccinated. The other thing I just wanted to point out, the statistics for the table, that didn't come from the FBI. It came from, is it some nonprofit organization that you tapped for that?
Yeah, it's called the Officer Down Memorial Page. They track law enforcement deaths throughout the country and report them publicly.
But I think all that underscores what a jigsaw you had to work with there in terms of data. You know?
Right. Yeah, it was a challenge getting reliable information, but I tried to communicate in the story, this is the best we have, and to try and draw conclusions as best as we could from what we had.
Well, all good information. Thanks for the update on Prop A and what's going on internally there at the police department. Thanks so much for joining us, Austin.
Great. Yeah, thanks for having me on again, Bob.
Up next here on co-op.org and on the 91.7 HD3 channel is Youth Spin in its new slot. And that's all for this evening. Stay safe, everyone.